you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week, Andy Klein and Christy Lemire, review the latest thriller from M. Night Shyamalan, Old, starring Gael Garcia Bernal. The G.I. Joe spin-off Snake Eyes stars Henry Golding, and actor Val Kilmer's profiled in the documentary Val. We're hearing music from the soundtrack of one of his most well-known films, The Doors, in which Kilmer played Jim Morrison. Also this week, the Netflix romantic drama, The Last Letter from Your Lover, starring Felicity Jones and Shailene Woodley. And our John Horn talks with the director of an upcoming documentary on the great dancer, choreography, Alvin Ailey. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. Before we get to all the movies, let's introduce our critics this week. They are Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Andy Klein joining us as well to review a wide range of films, beginning with the latest thriller from M. Night Shyamalan. He writes and directs Old, starring Gael Garcia Bernal. Christy, what did you think of Old?
You know, it's nutty. It's really silly at times, but I dug it. Eventually, I had a good time. It is an M. Night Shyamalan movie, so of course you're always looking for that twist, for that, you know, supernatural, surreal thing that's going on underneath all of this. Here it takes place at this luxurious resort where several families have converged, including Gael Garcia Bernal and Vicky Creeps and their two kids. And the guy who runs the place says, there's this secret cove that no one knows about. No tourists, we can take you out there. You'll have a beautiful day. The beach is incredible. They say, sure, of course. Other families also say, sure, of course. And in no time, bizarre things start happening, including the fact that they are all aging rapidly. And so the mystery is, how do we get off of this beach? What is really happening here? And he embraces the kind of over-the-top silliness of it, but there's enough style going on that I was always hooked. I mean, his camera work is always sublime. His usual cinematographer, Mike Giolakis, who has done his past several films, shot it. So there's a lot of really showy camera work going on here. And it's a great cast, as you mentioned. Also, Thomasin McKenzie is in it, Rufus Sewell, Abby Lee. And only once they begin to explain and really spell out what's going on does it fall apart. But I was kind of into it for a while.
We're talking about the movie Old, which we should mention is not an original M. Night Shyamalan concept for the film. His screenplay is based on the graphic novel Sandcastle. Andy, what do you think of Old?
Well, I'm a little less sympathetic than Christy. Yeah, I thought it was fun in its way. And I agree that Shyamalan is a really good director as a director. And I think Sixth Sense was a great film, but I don't think he's had a script since that comes near that. And that's true here as well. I mean, this is a kind of a wacky concept, and it's not really applied in a, you know, I'm going to get into like time travel problems.
As you should, Andy, we count on you for that.
I always like to.
Yes.
I mean, some of what is explained at the end makes no sense, really. And the explanation is not altogether satisfying. it's morally, you know, somebody makes a moral case for what's going on, which is not at all moral, and then that's kind of rebutted. But basically, the whole thing that's been set up there, that's why they are aging so quickly, is, kind of, like I say, it's not internally consistent at all. The other thing that's not consistent is that the little kids don't just age physically. They mature emotionally and intellectually. It's clear at the end, or near the end, let me say, not to spoil anything, when the preteens have now are in their 40s, that they are not just preteens stuck in the bodies of people in their 40s. That they have somehow grown into adulthood internally. There's also one of the subplots involving a trophy wife that I just thought was really awful and over the top and obvious. You know, the trophy wife who is so upset that, oh my God, you know, she's starting to get wrinkles. And then she gets something else that I don't even understand what it was supposed to be, but I found that kind of like a cheap shot. Rufus Sewell is very good playing what would have been an Ian McShane role 30 years ago. He really kind of looks like the guy now. And Bernal and the rest of the cast are fine. It's just not entirely satisfying.
Andy, I'm so glad to have you back to do that in-depth analysis of time travel. It's really, I missed it. Thank you for that. Christy, a quick rejoinder on Old.
Well, yeah, some things don't make sense, right? They don't all age at the same rate. So it does leave some questions, but I think the ambiguity of that is kind of what's tantalizing. And then when they do explain what's really going on here at the very end, and then they explain it, and then they explain it again, that's not nearly as interesting.
We're talking about M. Night Shyamalan's film. He wrote and directed Old, starring Gael Garcia Bernal. The film's rated PG-13, and it's in wide release. The G.I. Joe spinoff Snake Eyes stars Henry Golding, Andrew Koji, and Samara Weaving. Robert Schwentke is the director, and the screenwriters are Evan Spilotopoulos, Joe Shrapnel, and Anna Waterhouse. Christy, what'd you think of Snake Eyes?
Oh, it's just so dumb. Oh, it's just
dumb
the
good
action.
Or dumb bad?
No, dumb bad. And I'm down for dumb good. You know, I am not above so bad that it's good. But this is a movie that takes Henry Golding and somehow manages to like drain him of all that is interesting about him. I mean, he's this beautiful, charismatic, handsome man. If you saw Crazy Rich Asians or A Simple Favor, I mean, he's got that movie star thing. And here they stick him in a role as the titular Snake Eyes, who is a G.I. Joe character, who is, as a character, he's supposed to be mute, right? And he's supposed to wear a helmet all the time. And so what they've done with Henry Golding is, oh, that's not really a helmet. And they just make him say, you know, incredibly banal dialogue instead. So this is an origin story of this G.I. Joe, you know, comics character, this Hasbro toy. And it's basically a revenge story of, you know, trying to seek out the assassin who killed his father when he was a boy. And he joins this super secret ninja clan to train to try to find out the identity of this person. But he's also caught between trying to serve the Yakuza master who also was trying to help him with his revenge. I'm making this sound way more thrilling than it actually is. What is amazing, Robert Schwentke directed this, and he did the second and third Divergent movies as well as RIPD, and has no feel for action at all. He's made a lot of action movies, but this is shot with so much shaky cam and it's edited so erratically that it's impossible to tell what anyone is doing, which is a problem when it's a movie about super secret ninjas, right? Like you wanna see the choreography. And among the cast is Iko Uwais, who was in the Raid movies, who's this like Indonesian martial arts star. Like he's amazing. And what he's doing, everybody else here is like all chalked up and like, impossible to follow. Anyway, a couple of females actors here too. We have Haruka Abe and Samara Weaving, as you mentioned, and Ursula Corbero, but they don't really get to do a whole lot. It's also all of 2 hours long.
Snake Eyes, the film directed by Robert Schwentke, rated PG-13 in wide release. The action comedy Jolt stars Kate Beckinsale, Stanley Tucci, and Jai Courtney. Tanya Wexler directed the film. Scott Washa is the screenwriter. Andy, what'd you think of Jolt?
Okay, if you want a good dumb movie this weekend, I think Jolt is the one. Unlike Old, Jolt actually sort of internally makes sense. I mean, it's based on a premise that's ridiculous, but once you accept that premise, it's at least internally consistent. Beckinsale plays a woman who's got some sort of electrochemical disorder, something that she was born with, that floods her with cortisol, which I assume is some form of cortisone, so that she is able to suddenly be 20 times stronger than she should be and 20 times faster, and she has no impulse control. So basically, if anybody, you know, looks cross-eyed at her, she goes nuts and tears them apart. And she's now being controlled through a therapist played by Stanley Tucci, who's come up with this, like, she has to wear this electric vest with little shock things on her and a remote control that will shock her and stop the attacks when they happen. Unfortunately, because of her whole upbringing, she's very, very guy shy and very antisocial. And she meets a guy on a blind date, and he's really nice. And they spend the night, and it's the first time she's been able to trust anybody. And then the next day, he's murdered. And she goes bananas trying to find the murderers, with the cops running after her, trying to stop her, because they know that how out of control she is. Basically, it's very much like the setup in the Scarlett Johansson film Lucy, or the James McAvoy film Wanted, where somebody just has this hyper mode they go into, where they're essentially superhuman. It moves a mile a minute. I don't think it ever slows down. It was entirely enjoyable once you accept the idiotic premise. And I had a fun time with it. I thought it was good, and Tucci is good as always. And then there's another movie star who shows up, who I won't reveal, who shows up in one shot at the end.
All right, Jolt is the film. Christy, what'd you think?
I enjoyed it too. And I love Kate Beckinsale getting to show off how funny she can be. I mean, she's done so many dopey action movies over the years, but she's so smart and has really tremendous timing beyond being just a stunningly beautiful statuesque creature. And so to see her use that wit is as thrilling as any of the action she's called upon here to do, which of course she can also pull off with great elan. Yeah, the clothes are great. It's this like parallel universe to our modern day actual society, but everything's just a little bit heightened, a little bit more grungy. Tanya Wexler, who directed this, is the niece of the late great cinematographer Haskell Wexler. And there's just a great eye for mood and style here. Stanley Tucci is kind of like deliciously sardonic. The movie star that Andy refers to has a big chunk of voiceover at the very, very beginning, explaining kind of the rules of this world and this character's condition that goes on way, way, way too long. And I'm like, is this going to be a movie that tells us everything instead of showing us? But it eventually does pay off. And also Bobby Cannavale is in this and Laverne Cox. So it's a very strong supporting cast. And I had a good time.
Jolt is the action comedy. Tanya Wexler directs. It's rated R and it's available on Amazon Prime Video for streaming at home. The documentary Val is focused on Val Kilmer. The film's directed by Ting Poo and Leo Scott. Christy, what'd you think of Val?
Oh, it's riveting and it's just so sad. And it's so intimate that it's like almost uncomfortable at times. Like it's so personal and it's so raw at times. Val Kilmer has had a video camera for a long time and he shot everything forever and kept scrapbooks and scripts. And so we have this wonderful inside look at just decades of this incredible and versatile career. But going back earlier than that, growing up in Chatsworth and, you know, his dreams of being an actor from very young at Chatsworth High School. And his high school girlfriend was Mayor Whittingham. We go back to all the way back to that. So it's a good LA story. But his son, Jack, who is also an actor, narrates it because throat cancer has stripped Val Kilmer of that beautiful, rich voice that he's used in so many versatile ways in so many different kinds of films. And so we do hear him speak, and he sounds like this. He has to speak through this hole in his throat. And so it's very sad in that we see where he is now, and he's sort of, you know, struggling to stay relevant in some contexts and struggling with his own fame and with what he knows is the end of his acting career. And but it's also a really cool look back behind the scenes at like Top Gun, at him, you know, performing on stage with a young Kevin Bacon and a young Sean Penn, and the work he did to get ready for The Doors. So if you love movies and you're a fan of Val Kilmer, you will dig it. But I found it ultimately really moving and really sad.
Val, the documentary we were talking about. Andy, can you give us about 30 seconds at least start, and we can come back to you after the break?
Sure. I had mixed feelings about this, and because it feels bad to kick a guy when he's down, and I felt that he really sort of writes off all the complaints people have had about working with him, which have been legendary. And this is kind of a mea culpa on some level, but he's not really taking the blame.
Hold that thought. We'll continue with Andy Klein. We're talking about the documentary Val. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Kristi Lemire, Andy Klein are with us. Back in 1 minute.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
This is Film Week on KPCC. Larry Mantle with critics Andy Klein and Kristi Lemire. Coming up later this hour, our John Horn talks with director Jamila Whitnot, whose new documentary, Ailey, explores the life and legacy of the dancer and choreographer Alan Ailey, his dance company legendary, of course, and Ailey himself, a remarkable figure in choreography and dance. That's coming up later this hour. But right now, we're talking about the documentary Val, which features Val Kilmer, the longtime actor. The film is directed by Ting Pu and Leo Scott. Andy, you were saying just briefly before we broke that you felt like this wasn't necessarily fully candid about some of the difficulties that Kilmer had with his co-workers on films?
Yeah, I mean, he does try and mount a defense, the defense of being, you know, a perfectionist. And again, it's hard. Look, I mean, you look at the guy in this film, and it's there's no way not to be moved that he, you know, he is kind of physically such a mess now. And it's tragic. And he tries to be appreciative of all the good things, all the luck he had, as well as his talent. But I wished it had been a little more self-critical. I wish it had been just a tad more distant in looking at his life and career than it was.
Yeah, and Kristi, did you feel that absence at all?
I mean, it's his perspective, right? It's his take on his life. And not only does he not really acknowledge that he has been notoriously difficult to work with, he adds voices of people like Robert Downey Jr., who he co-starred with in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is so great, saying like, no, you're not difficult. You just want to get it right. Or something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing. And so it's his version of his life. It's his story. And it's not trying to be even remotely warts and all. Having said that, the warts do reveal themselves in the present day footage that we see, and they speak for themselves.
You having interviewed him a number of years ago, I was a little scared in advance because I'd heard of his reputation, but He was terrific. It was really nice, and seemed to enjoy his experience of joining us. Val is the documentary. It's rated R. It's in select theaters, but can also be seen starting August 6th on Amazon Prime Video. The French comedy Mandibles is written and directed by Quentin Dupieux. The film is unrated, and it's at the Landmark New Art Theater in West L.A. and on on-demand platforms. Andy, what did you think of Mandibles?
Well, I love Quentin Dupieux. Frankly, he's definitely an acquired taste. He did a film about 10 years ago called Rubber, which we probably did on the show, which was about...
The tire. Yes.
The tire that's roaming around the Southwest killing people. And he's done a couple films since then that I've continued to find really interesting and wacky. This is actually a little more, can I even say, reality-based? This does not play with who's watching the film. There's no meta stuff going on in this one. This is about two absolute idiots who are supposed to be doing what appears to be an illegal, you know, like a drug drop. And they steal a car to do it in, and in the trunk is a fly that's about the size of a medium-sized German Shepherd, maybe a little bigger. And they decide, why should we do this other stuff when we can train this fly, and the fly will go into stores and rob stuff and bring it back out to us, which is about the stupidest plan possible, but they get to work on it. And, they have misadventures when they end up crashing with a house full of people, and they're trying to pretend that the fly's not there. And one of the people had some brain injury and keeps trying to convince people, I saw the fly, I saw this thing. And everybody, you know, and they're just sending her off to the asylum. It's very slight. It doesn't, like I say, it doesn't play with reality in the way some of his earlier films did. But there's just something so wacky, quirky about his sensibility that I got to admit I'm a sucker for this guy. And his and the fly snores really loudly.
How does he come up with these concepts? We're talking about French writer-director Quentin Dupieux. The film stars Grégoire Ludwig and David Marseille. The film's unrated. You can see it at the Landmark New Art Theater in West L.A. It's also on Amazon Prime Video, iTunes, Vudu, Fandango, Now, Mandibles. The Last Letter from Your Lover is a romantic drama starring Felicity Jones, Shailene Woodley, and Calum Turner. The film is directed by Augustine Frizzell and written by Nick Payne and Esther Spalding. Christy, tell us about The Last Letter from Your Lover.
This is based on a book by Jojo Moyes, but it would have, if it had come out in 1965 when the flashbacks are set, this would have been thought of as a women's picture, because this is very much like a highfalutin soap opera. It is beautiful to look at, and the clothes are fantastic, and there's forbidden love, and there's a flashback structure to a romance that could never be, and maybe it could be again. And it's just a well-made, solid, like, romance that if you're flipping around through Netflix and you find it, it's a good couch sit. You'll be into it. Felicity Jones is a reporter at a newspaper in London, and she stumbles upon this letter, this mysterious letter. And it's clearly about, you know, it's from a man to a woman about the affair that they have had. And she begins to look into it more and more. And as she does, the film flashes back to that actual affair, which Shailene Woodley's character has with Calum Turner. She is this unhappily married society wife. She's American. Her husband's this British up-and-coming politician and power player, played by Joe Alwyn. They would seem to have it all on the surface, but they're not really in love with each other. But she has this great spark with this British reporter, played by Calum Turner. And so it goes back and forth between Felicity Jones trying to uncover the mystery of who these people are in these letters, along with the help from this uptight archive room clerk, played by Nabhan Rizwan, And it goes back and forth between their romance, which is not nearly as interesting as the one that takes place in Italy in the 60s. And it's like giant sun-brimmed hats and like gloves and driving through the winding hills in a convertible. And what's interesting is that Augustine Frizzell, this is a totally different kind of movie for her from one that she made a couple years ago called Never Going Back, which was like a raunchy best girlfriend comedy, the kind of movie that usually gets made about guys. And this is girls being like aimless and raunchy and profane. This is so like polite, but it's cool. And it's got a soundtrack of great female artists from Marianne Faithfull to Aretha Franklin. It's all women's voices throughout this. And it is a good, high-minded soap. I liked it.
All right. Augustine Frizzell, the director of The Last Letter from Your Lover, starring Felicity Jones and Shailene Woodley. The film's rated TV mature, and it's on Netflix, the streaming service. The Czech drama Charlatan is directed by Agnieszka Holland. Marek Epstein is the screenwriter of Charlatan. Andy.
Holland is a Czech/Polish director who actually had a career here for a while. She directed The Secret Garden and the remake of Washington Square with Jennifer Jason Leigh. And she's best known for Europa, Europa, which was an Oscar nominee back in around 1990. This film is a biopic of a Czech herbalist who worked through the 30s through the 50s and had a technique that involved entirely analysis by visual inspection of urine. That's it. And he diagnoses everybody just by looking in the sunlight, looking at their urine, and prescribes herbs. He is a favorite, apparently, all over the country. He has hundreds of patients. Big government officials use him. He indeed, at some point, treats Martin Bormann during the occupation. And now he's been treating major Communist Party figures in the 50s, but his biggest connection in the government dies, and now the new guys are out to get him. And they frame him up on a charge. All of this is in the context of the other side we see of him, which is that he's madly in love with his male assistant, who's this hunky young guy. And their romance involves some real cruelty towards the lover's wife, which I won't go into detail of. But it makes you not like this guy very much. And I also am kind of dubious about this whole medical treatment when we're in the middle of a world where medical misinformation is a big deal. I don't believe that you can prescribe everything and diagnose everything from glancing at a tube of urine. I don't get it.
All right. The film is Charlatan. Agnieszka Holland is the director. Marek Epstein is the screenwriter. The film's unrated. It's at a couple of the Lemley theaters, including the Royal in West L.A. and Lemley's Glendale. Joe Bell stars Mark Wahlberg, Ronaldo, Marcus Green as the director, Diana Ossana, and Larry McMurtry are the screenwriters of Joe Bell. Christy.
This is based on the true story of a father who tried to walk across the country to bring attention to bullying because his son, who was gay, was bullied and tormented in small town La Grande, Oregon. And so it's based on a true story. Ronaldo Marcus Green, who directed it, had kind of an indie hit a couple years back called Monsters and Men. This feels much more formulaic and safe and staid. Sadly, this is the last, looks like probably the last screenplay from the great Larry McMurtry. It's incredibly formulaic and kind of mawkish, although its heart is obviously in the right place. Mark Wahlberg plays this father named Joe Bell, who, you know, aims to change hearts and minds. And he was a close-minded conservative guy before his teenage son came out to him as gay. And he wants to change others' minds as well. If you know this kid's story, then maybe you know what is happening here. If you don't know what his story is, there is a thing that happens about a third of the way through where it like yanks the rug out from underneath you, which I found really gimmicky and kind of cheap and very frustrating. I don't think the story needed this device. There's enough to work with here. But the young actor who plays his son, Reed Miller, is really good and brings great truth to the role. It's a flashback structure back and forth between the walk and what happened to this kid in high school. And it's just earnest and formulaic. And I kind of wanted more from all these people, but also it's a movie about a gay character told through the eyes of the straight sort of hero savior figure, which I find frustrating quite often. I would like to have seen it through Jaden's eyes.
Joe Bell, the film starring Mark Wahlberg, Reed Miller, and Connie Britton. Ronaldo Marcus Green, the director. It's rated R in select theaters. Stuntman, a documentary which features Eddie Braun and the team behind his stunts. Kurt Matilla is the director of Stuntman. Andy.
Eddie Braun is a longtime Hollywood stuntman who has been obsessed since youth with the idea of recreating Evel Knievel's attempt to ride a rocket across the Snake River Gorge in Idaho. And Evel Knievel failed, but lived through it. And Eddie has been working on this for 40 years. And a lot of this story is about his frustrations getting backing for the Fox says they're gonna back it and make it a primetime thing, but then when the first test run fails, they kind of back out, and then TNT comes in and leaves. And finally, the film is rescued by Dwayne Johnson, who actually introduces it with a great tribute to Eddie Braun, who goes and does this thing. And I don't think it's giving anything away to say that he doesn't die.
We're talking about, hold that thought, Stuntman's the film, because we're a little short on time, and I do want to hear what Christy thinks of it.
So his story, what drives him to do this crazy thing, and just what's driven him to be a stuntman for decades now, is way more interesting than the will we or won't we have the funding for this stunt. It gets really caught up in its own like logistics in a way that is a bit of a drag. But Eddie Braun, Manhattan Beach guy, you know, father of four, salt of the earth, he's a fascinating character.
Stuntman is the documentary. It's unrated and streaming on Disney Plus. We'll continue our John Horn coming up next on Film Week. You're listening to Film Week on KCC. I'm Larry Mantle. The new documentary, Ailey, is more than just a portrait of choreographer and dancer Alvin Ailey. It takes a deep dive into the intricate and complicated person he was. Ailey was notoriously private about his personal life, but as an artist, he was incredibly gifted, choreographing dozens of works, including the ballet Revelations. It remains among the most popular and most performed around the world. Ailey was also a trailblazer for other young black dancers and performing artists who saw him on stage, thought maybe they could be a professional dancer too. The film is out in New York City this weekend and expands on August 6th. Earlier this week, our John Horn talked with the film's director, Jamila Wignott, and started by asking her how challenging it was to tell the story of a man who was so private.
That part of it was, you know, very surprising to us as we kind of embarked on this journey. And I think, you know, the solution for us was really to then essentially depict what it was he was willing to share, in which case those audio recordings that he conducted in the last year of his life from 1988 to 1989, became the sort of foundation for us. And I think there's a lot in those tapes that he shares his the real sort of heartbreak of his early childhood, the abandonment of his father, you know, which it's clear he never gets over, that's early sexual awakening, his mental health struggles. So I think there was a lot in there that he was willing to share, and he wanted to control that. And I think, you know, sort of where we landed at the end was understanding that ultimately this is a kind of portraiture of an artist as opposed to an act of, you know, journalism or expose, or even, you know, the sort of more deep dive work that a written biographical work can do. And that's where we landed.
I was listening to an interview with Novak Djokovic after he won Wimbledon, and he said something that was very interesting, and he's won a couple of titles. He said, as a seven-year-old, he was in his bedroom using like various found objects from his house to build his own Wimbledon trophy. Like, he had this imagination of what it would look like. And so he built this kind of homemade, I'm sure it looks terrible, but for him, it was what he aspired to. And it was very different for Alvin Ailey, because there was nobody like him that he could picture himself emulating. So his dream was mostly imaginary until he sees somebody dance, and that's Katherine Dunham. So who is Katherine Dunham, and what does she awaken in Ailey that is so profound in who he becomes and what he does?
Yeah, thank you for bringing her up. I love that scene, in part because it so much parallels my experience of discovering Mr. Ailey and the Ailey Company as well, kind of this happenstance moment. So Katherine Dunham is an early pioneer in modern dance. I don't think she's always kind of listed amongst the sort of pantheon of modern dancers, in part because her work was really sort of anthropologically based. So it wasn't that that people saw her work as always sort of transforming these studies she would do mostly in Haiti, but really it was her kind of restaging Haitian dance practices and religious practices for the theatrical stage. She was also an actress and appeared in several Hollywood movies, and, you know, overall just a very glamorous figure. And it's clear that Ailey was drawn to these very glamorous women. What she represents for him is a real opening, because he is, you know, called to, drawn to, pulled by this form. There's a sense he wants to move his body. He's attracted to dance. He's taken by, you know, the ballets that he's taking in at that time. But at that moment, he hadn't seen, you know, any sort of entry point for himself. And so and this is what we loved about his story, these moments of serendipity. He goes downtown, he sees a poster on a wall of this dance troupe, and he's like, what is this? And finds his way inside, and then there it is, you know. And it's her accessing some kind of, I think, traditions of the African diaspora that feel in relationship to these early years of his boyhood in Texas. And I think it is that moment where he realizes, oh, there's a chance for me. And in part, there's because these men on stage, right? And it's so, once we saw that footage, I was thinking about, you know, just,
well,
even the costuming
let's add
that
to
they
this.
Share.
They are black men.
Yes.
And black men, up to this point, the only place you would see them in a modern dance or ballet performance is as ushers. They were never on stage.
And
we can talk about the implications of tap and kind of minstrelly, but here is somebody, here he's seen somebody who he's never seen before, who doesn't really exist in the normal dance world.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think, and the way, you know, you hear it, that's what I love about those tapes, is that, you know, in the public interviews, he does obviously talk about Dunham and these experiences, but in this audio recording where he's looser and he's really kind of through a process of kind of incantation and exploring his own memories, he is transported back to that moment. And the way he talks about, like, the sensuality, the jumps, the agility, it's so clear to him that the things he has already excelled at, you know, but he's doing it in a kind of rhythm dance gymnastics, it's this kind of possibility is suddenly there for him. And it's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's something we would call at the time, probably because we didn't know any better, world music. And this is an era when almost all dance is to things like Tchaikovsky, that the idea of contemporary and non-European music being an influence for dance is non-existent. And that not only opens his imagination, but it also makes, I would argue, his dance accessible to a different audience. Not only is he using black dancers, but he's also starting to use music that is not kind of old white people's music. I think it's a fair way to describe it. So let's talk about the music, because it's really important that is a path to creating a relationship with an audience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's something that's interesting about Mr. Ailey's process that, you know, sometimes the music came first. And I think that you sort of feel that and you can see it in the way that the dance is so kind of obviously rhythmically in sync. But yeah, even with his first dance work, it's blues, you know, and he wasn't the only one. I mean, amongst his cohort, there were other people experimenting with this. But I think that is a kind of entry point, a welcoming point, a way in which the abstraction of modern dance, which can be difficult for audiences, it's like, oh, but I know this music, I feel this music. You know, it's an entry point. I think that he certainly cared about accessibility and entertainment and kind of hooking the audience in and introducing them to this form.
I want to talk about something that is referenced in a performance of Mr. Ailey's, and that is the assassination, I think we can call that, of Fred Hampton in 1969. Fred Hampton was a Black Panther. He was targeted by the FBI. He was drugged and shot by the police. His life was chronicled in the recent movie Judas and the Black Messiah. Alvin Ailey noticed and responded to what happened. And I want to play a clip where he's working with a dancer about a piece that I think is largely inspired by the murder or assassination of Fred Hampton. Let's listen to this conversation with one of his dancers.
Nice. Stop the music, would you? Yeah. Now, let's try the... I want to feel like you're in jail, like you're behind bars. And I want to feel all the anger and the cutting. I want to feel like you're being pressed down when you take the arabesque. I want to feel a sense of cursing at the outside world. Yeah, let's try it again.
I love that conversation. I mean, it's a great burden for a dancer to have to perform.
And that notion, yeah, I was just going to say that notion of embodiment. What I always hear when I see the film and, you know, when we were working with this, press down in the arabesque. Like an arabesque is free and supposed to be up and light. And he's saying, no, you got to do that, but you got to be pushing up against something. So to understand that your attempt at flight and lightness is weighted down. And I, you know, the other part of this version of Masekela that we found was, you know, reviving the original ending that Mr. Ailey, you know, had as part of that performance, which isn't currently how it's done, where he is turning his attention then to the audience and thanking them for witnessing what is a murder that takes place on stage. A lifeless body is presented to the audience, and he says, thank you, you know. And I think there's an
interest. Why was that cut?
I don't know why the company doesn't continue or why Mr. Ailey doesn't.
I have to say it's more effective.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much, I think, you know, probably in conversation with Revelations. You love Revelations because I think it gives you this notion of kind of collective community and catharsis. And Masekela is the other side of the coin where he's saying you can't walk out of this theater not thinking about this.
It's director Jamila Wicknott and our John Horn talking about Wicknott's new documentary, Ailey, out this week in New York City, then expands nationwide August 6th. It's Film Week on KPCC. More of John's interview in just 1 minute.
Taro Ale is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Let's get you back to John Horn's interview with director Jamila Wicknott about her new documentary, Ailey. It tells the story of the life, career, and legacy of the African-American dancer, choreographer, and activist Alvin Ailey.
One of the things that any young artist typically has to encounter is struggles. And there was an interesting struggle that Alvin Ailey had early in his career with this company. And that was a U.S. state department-sponsored tour. And the government was, you know, on the surface, an artistic benefactor. But there were a lot of strings there. They wanted to make sure that the company was presented as ethnic and not modern. They supervised him. The FBI supervised him because they didn't want his homosexuality. I'm quoting the FBI now to say that he had lewd and criminal tendencies. They threatened his company with bankruptcy if he stepped out of line. So even when he started to have success and was on a government-sponsored tour, he couldn't be the person he was, and people were watching him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as an individual, he couldn't be, be fully who he was. And yet at the same time, he remained, you know, open to everyone around him. So there's this kind of public what's happening on the proscenium stage and you know, at the galas, and then who he is with his company and the fact that they knew. I would also argue that he doesn't alter his work for them. I mean, they can present them as ethnic, but they are also being sent there as a mission to be a showcase of American enlightenment when it comes to race relations. So this is a company that goes on its first tour in 1962. I mean, there's just no, we do not have voting rights in place. We do not have housing rights in place. There are so many ways that, you know, Birmingham has yet to happen where the dogs are unleashed, and, you know, and there he is, you know, meant to perform this. And I don't think he alters his work, because again, I think his message was about getting at, and, you know, what defines Black life and not what shapes it. And he was going to go and perform that, you know, on stage and use it, you know, it is I think there's a use that's happening for him as well. He gets to have a company. He gets to tour. He gets to get his message out there. It's way complicated, but it's also no different than, you know, artists today who have to work with capitalist funders of all sorts,
like
right?
Like documentary filmmakers. There are, you know, some amazing principal dancers in the company. I'm thinking of people like Clifton Brown, Solomon Dumas, Samantha Figgins. And for them, you know, just like Catherine Dunham was to Alvin Ailey, when they were growing up, and other dancers or people of color or Black, when they saw that company come to town, they saw something they'd never seen before. So not only is Alvin Ailey kind of recruiting and finding a new audience, he's also showing future dancers that there is a place for them, which I can argue is almost as important as the work itself, that he show the possibility of a young Black girl or boy that they could dance to, that they didn't have to wear tights and dance the Nutcracker.
Right. And I love, in the cases of some of his work that are very balletic, they could also do that, you know. And I think that's why I loved, when we interviewed George Faison, and just that he said that same thing. There's a kind of recurring theme here of possibility and potential, and that sense of, you know, there is an opening. And tragically, we continue to need those reminders. You know, we're still grappling with representation today, and I think he showed for so many generations, and he continues to show to people today, that it's possible.
And yet, you know, so much of our modern history is reflected in what he had to do and what he had to keep secret. He died in late 1989 from AIDS complications. And I think he asked his doctor to say that he had some sort of blood disorder so that his mom was not embarrassed for him, or that she was not stigmatized, right?
Yes, that is correct. I can't remember the name of the blood disease that they, you know, put in his obituary, but
Dyscrasia.
Right. And I, you know, what I think is interesting about that is, for anyone within the community, everyone knows what it means to have a rare blood disorder in 1989. And, you know, that is such a complicated choice. We didn't want to leave him off the hook. And so we allowed, you know, Bill T. Jones to sort of speak to the complexity of that choice. And I think therein again is, what is the individual choice that Ailey could make in that moment? What are the repercussions of that for a platform he had built and an institution that would certainly not, there is just no way, given who was on the board, who the funders were, that you know, the institution can survive, and his personal need to disclose his status. I think it's a thing that from where we sit today is easy to look back on with judgment. And there's something disappointing in it too. You know, we want our icons to be all and everything for us. And the fact that he couldn't align himself with that in that moment, I think it's fair to be disappointed in him.
So a dancer leaves behind his, her, or their dances through notation. It's, you know, a recording of steps. And sometimes it's done on paper. Today it's kind of done on video. So Alvin Ailey leaves behind, through notation and video, his dances. But what does he leave behind that is more intangible, that isn't written down or recorded? What is his legacy beyond the steps and the moves and the choreography? How would you define that?
I think what he leaves behind is this thing that we've been talking about, was just the sense of possibility, a sense of, you know, when he says, I wanted it to be easier than it was for me, a sense of, you know, we can all come together. If you have an interest in this form, it is here for you. And I think also this idea of arts and the highest arts, as dance is considered, is for everyone. It is for everyone. And I think he was a true evangelist for that. And there is something, you know, I talk about this in these interviews, that, you know, my daughter was taking lessons at Ailey pre-pandemic. And so every Saturday we'd walk into that building. And it was just extraordinary, this like feeling of being in that space and this knowing that here, you know, here is a place that is still has that kind of warm embrace, as Miss Jameson calls it. And so it's very intangible, but I think there is a spirit of Ailey that lives on, which is kind of what, you know, the film is Ailey, because it is actually that, right? It is his spirit that lives on beyond him.
Jamila Wingnut is a producer and the director of the new documentary, Ailey. Jamila, thanks so much for taking time with us.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
That's John Horn in conversation with Jamila Wingnut, director of the new documentary, Ailey, out this week in New York City, and that expands nationwide starting August 6th. We hope you'll tune in that week and hear what our film week critics have to say about the documentary. I'm Larry Mantle. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.